This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
On the world today, more than 100 million people around the globe displaced from their homes, the toll of years of chaos. In South Asia, certainty that climate change is behind the recent heat waves there. And in Australia, climate change kickstarts a new political era.
This is the first time that voters have signaled to the political parties that they want clear action on climate change.
Also today, some Ukrainians appear to be using facial recognition software to identify dead Russian soldiers. With this kind of data collection, the question often is, how do we collect more?
It's never about the ethics of it. It's never about, should we? We can do these things, but should we? And the answer is absolutely always yes.
But now in Ukraine, an ethical dilemma about facial recognition being used to wage war. I'm Marco Werman. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It's good to have you here. President Biden is in Tokyo today, his first trip to Asia as president. In a news conference, Biden was asked about Taiwan.
You didn't want to get involved in the Ukraine conflict militarily for obvious reasons. Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made.
In Beijing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson Wang Wenbin said China is expressing strong dissatisfaction and resolute opposition to Biden's comments. We're joined now by Kurt Tong. He's a partner with the Asia Group and previously served as U.S. Ambassador for Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation. Ambassador, are you hearing a shift in U.S. policy right now on Taiwan?
A bit of a shift, Marco. I would describe what the president said in Tokyo as strategic ambiguity with attitude. As you know, the U.S. policy for a long time has been not to be very clear on what exactly the United States would do if there was a military situation surrounding Taiwan, while at the same time implementing the Taiwan Relations Act, which requires by law the United States to provide Taiwan with the material capability to defend itself. Given the Ukraine situation and given China's recent rhetoric and actions surrounding Taiwan, I think that the U.S. is leaning more towards the side of trying to deter China and therefore is speaking a bit stronger in more strong terms about the issue, but also not committing to any specific action.
I mean, Chinese planes making provocative flights on the edge of Taiwan's airspace, that's one thing. What action are you most worried about that China would take beyond that? And if that happens, do you really believe the U.S. would step in?
The kind of scenarios that could be most worrisome in the near term would be so-called gray zone scenarios, where the PRC, the People's Republic of China, could try to make life extremely difficult for Taiwan without invading. For example, by declaring a no-fly zone or trying to limit access for commercial shipping into and out of Taiwan, or cyber attacks. Those are all worrisome scenarios and all things that Taiwan needs to be ready to try and defend itself against.
Well, interestingly, also today, Biden announced the launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. It's described as a counterweight to Chinese influence in the region. How big of a deal is that?
I think the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework is quite a big deal. There are people who are comparing it to the Trans-Pacific Partnership that the United States left and saying that it's not as big a deal as that was. But another point of comparison would be the APEC process, which is a consensus-based process of 21 economies, trying to figure out good ways of improving how business is done in the region and make the economies more responsive to priorities like combating climate change, like developing infrastructure, like coming up with rules for digital commerce. Those topics have been discussed in APEC for a long time. They're going to be discussed now in this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework among a somewhat smaller group. I think it's an interesting initiative and should be given time to see whether it turns into some useful developments for the region.
Well, one thing to note, Taiwan is not included in the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. Why is that? Do you see it as a mistake?
No, I don't see it as a mistake, personally. I think the United States wanted to have a lot of participation from Southeast Asian nations. In order to do so, they needed to agree not to have Taiwan participate because of the sensitivities of those countries. That said, the good path forward for the U.S. and Taiwan is bilaterally, to try and move forward with cementing the U.S.-Taiwan economic relationship more concretely. One idea that's out there and has a lot of support in Congress is to do a bilateral trade agreement much along the lines of a typical comprehensive free trade agreement. That seems to be more realistic now than it's ever been, and certainly is worth exploring.
Ambassador Kurt Tong is a partner with the Asia Group. He's been speaking with us about U.S.-Taiwan relations as President Biden makes his first trip to Asia as president. Ambassador, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
In Geneva this week, leaders from around the globe are convening for the 75th World Health Assembly. In his opening speech, Director General of the WHO, Tedros Ghebreyesus, said war, hunger, and disease are all intertwined. The meeting comes as COVID, but also many other diseases, impact nations across the globe. The World's Alana Gordon covers global health for our show and joins me now. First of all, Alana, what is the World Health Assembly? What does it do?
So the World Health Assembly is the governing body of the World Health Organization. And it's basically when delegates from about 190 member states, these are usually health ministers, they get together and do the work to address the biggest global health problems the world faces. So no big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. A huge mandate, in fact. What in particular stands out in this mandate?
Well, there's a lot going on. For one, the pandemic is not over. And the gathering this week, more than anything, represents a really important inflection point. Many see this as a chance for the world to reset and do better. I talked to Salim Abdul-Karim about this. He's a leading epidemiologist in South Africa.
We have to find a new way in which we work together. There is no scenario in the world that sees some countries suppressing and controlling the virus while it is spreading rampantly in other settings. That's not a success.
And Marco, just last week, a major report commissioned by the World Health Assembly, actually, it concluded that the world really is in no better place to respond to pandemics than it was 2 years ago. And given the economic impact, we might even be in a worse place right now.
I mean, that sounds like a really, really tall order. What can global health leaders actually do this week to reset and find a way to work together?
One thing that is kind of obvious, but maybe not, is that this meeting has been virtual the past couple years, and now it's actually in person. So leaders are literally able to come together and move forward these debates.
But exactly how would a multinational body like the World Health Assembly find solutions?
Well, there are some critical debates about how the world acts in a pandemic that are taking place right now, like what responsibilities individual countries have to one another. You know, Marco, ahead of this week's meeting, there's been conspiracy theories flying around about the WHO imposing like a global government on people's lives. But the thing is, the WHO is not an enforcement agency, and any new international guidelines it comes up with have to be passed by legislatures around the world. So that's what makes this all really tricky. And what is being discussed is about how to build a stronger global framework for confronting health threats like a pandemic and how to fund it. You know, this is a long-term process. It's going to take months, if not years, to come up with real movement on this.
Yeah, I mean, it is really daunting. One last question, Alana. I've got to ask you about monkeypox, which is making a lot of headlines right now. How concerning is that among global health leaders meeting in Geneva this week?
While they are talking about monkeypox, it's not a new virus, though. It's mainly spread in forested areas from animals. What is new now is some cases have shown up in parts of Europe and North America. There was this social media Q&A session today. Here's what the WHO's Maria Van Kerkhove had to say.
We do need to put this into context because it's not COVID. So we have so far seen, and I don't actually have the exact numbers at hand because we're learning more as even as we sit here, but we're talking about less than about 200 cases of confirmed and suspected cases so far. So that may change over time. This is really important why we have surveillance and why we have raised an alert to say, okay, we need to be on the lookout for this.
So, Marco, they are keeping an eye on it. It's the early days of this outbreak. But again, it's not spreading like COVID. This virus is spread through close person-to-person contact. And Van Kerkhove was clear that this is going to require attention. They're still learning, but it can be contained.
Well, I mean, despite the troubling headlines, in a lot of ways, this kind of outbreak response to monkeypox just highlights the critical behind-the-scenes work in global health. The World's Alana Gordon, thank you very much for the updates.
Yeah, thanks, Marco.
Today, a 62-year-old retired school teacher got a hero's welcome in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. What did he do? The World's Halima Gikandi was at the airport when he arrived and explains.
Early this morning, a large crowd gathered outside the main international airport in Nairobi. They weren't there to get a glimpse of a famous musician or movie star, but for a new type of Kenyan celebrity. James Kagambi is a mountaineer who made it to the top of Mount Everest in Nepal earlier this month. His youngest daughter, Cynthia, was there in the crowd.
We really feel so nice that he's represented us as a family, us as Kenya, though. And this is a big achievement for all of us, and we are really, really happy about it.
She tells me it's been about a month and a half since she last saw her dad. As we talk, she keeps glancing around at the terminal entrance, waiting for the moment her father arrives. As he does, a group of traditional musicians begin to sing and dance. After the excitement dies down, James Kagambi tells me he's surprised by all of this attention.
I feel overwhelmed. I did not expect that many people here. So that is an honor. I'm not a person of too many people, but I understand the joy.
Kagambi has been mountaineering for decades. He summited many of the world's tallest mountains and worked as a guide and instructor for years. But he remembers the days when mountaineering in Kenya hardly got any attention at all.
One time, I was so disappointed. 1992, when I was asked to go represent Africa on the Eiger, on a climb, I had to sell everything I had to do it. And I did it. Why? I went to the cultural ministry. They said, we are sorry. This is not a sport.
The sport is gaining more attention now. Kagambi even has a corporate sponsor. That helped him get the necessary equipment and training to prepare for Everest, which brought him to the U.S.
I would say that the main part I did was from June all the way to November, being in the Rockies. I hiked a total of like 5 months. Being on snow.
Kagambi tells me that hiking in the Rockies in Wyoming during the winter was actually harder than climbing Everest. When he arrived in the Himalayas, he says he felt ready.
I know how to time myself. I know what I was dealing with. I knew the steepness. I knew when to increase the speed, when to lower the speed. I have one rule. Don't go out of breath, because when you go out of breath, that's when you feel like I want to give up.
Giving up wasn't an option, he tells me. The whole process took about 6 weeks. On May 12th, Kagambi made it to the summit of Mount Everest.
When I got up, I had so many things planned, but everything just, I was just so happy.
He made it to the top with 6 other mountaineers. They were part of the first ever all-black expedition to try making it to the top of the world's highest mountain.
One of the goals of us climbing as a black team on Everest was not only to show the world that we can do it. Well, we succeeded by doubling the number of blacks who are on the mountain now, and we would like to take more. But it's also diversity.
Kagambi says he wants to use this moment to inspire other Kenyans and people across Africa. Historically, even here, climbing is a sport dominated by foreigners.
I would like to encourage people to go out in the mountains, and not only out in the mountains, even hills, even hiking. Outdoors teach a lot.
As Kagambi readied to leave the airport, his friends and family broke out into a prayer. Victory, victory, they sang in Swahili. Hallelujah. Kagambi says he now plans to push for mountaineering to be recognized as an official sport in Kenya. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
You're listening to The World.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. In Australia,
please welcome to the stage the man set to be the 31st Prime Minister of Australia.
Anthony Albanese will be their next Prime Minister.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change.
Albanese's Labour Party won for only just the fourth time since World War II. We reached out to the editor of The Conversation Australia and New Zealand, Misha Ketchell, to talk about the significance of this election and why voters soured on the now outgoing Prime Minister, Scott Morrison.
There were two reasons voters rejected Scott Morrison. The first was his brand, his personal brand, was toxic. He was seen to have mishandled some natural disasters. Some bushfires were burning at one point in his prime ministership, and he went to Hawaii, which was viewed very negatively by the electorate. There was some criticism of his handling of COVID, although I think most people felt that overall that was reasonably well done. But the key issue was that the coalition has been dragging its heels on policies to address climate change, and voters were clearly very unhappy with that. A lot of the independent candidates who were voted in at this election were campaigning on climate change, ending corruption. And the third issue was gender in politics, the treatment of women in politics and in public life.
I'm curious to know what the last time was when climate change played such a huge role on the political agenda.
Well, it's interesting. Climate change has been a huge issue in Australia really for the past decade or more, in what's been termed by political commentators in Australia the climate wars. And both sides of politics, but particularly the coalition side, has tried to weaponize anxiety over the impact of policies to address climate change. But this is the first time that voters have signaled to the political parties that they want clear action on climate change.
So, assuming the ballot trends remain the same, Anthony Albanese will be Australia's new prime minister. What were the campaign promises he made that helped him win?
He promised to introduce a federal body to monitor and stamp out corruption, an anti-corruption commission. He promised a slightly more assertive target on carbon emissions reductions to address climate change. And during the campaign, he spoke about the impact of the cost of living and advocated for an increase in the minimum wage, which seems to have gone down well with the voters as well.
Misha, a lot of world leaders talk a good game on climate change, setting net zero goals, but with a seeming amount of foot dragging. Given that he campaigned centrally on climate change, how big could Albanese's role be getting other world leaders to focus on the dilemma?
Well, Albanese's target for climate reductions is not seen by many as hugely ambitious. Both sides of politics want to have zero emissions by 2050. That's a long-term goal, but the target is relatively modest. So I don't think you could say that the Australian Labor Party is leading the world on climate change at this point. Mm.
Albanese was sworn in and then got on a plane heading off to Japan to meet President Joe Biden and other world leaders. I mean, he's Australia's freshly minted prime minister. How big will China loom in these talks?
China is huge. Its geopolitical influence is significant. And obviously the division between the United States and China is something which clearly affects Australia. China's influence also became an issue during the course of the campaign when it was announced that China would be operating in the Solomon Islands, and that became a political issue. So China is a big issue, and it will be, I think, part of the discussions.
How different do you think Albanese will be on talking tough to China than, say, Scott Morrison?
I think both sides of politics will say different things to voters than they might behind closed doors, because obviously there is a complicated diplomatic scene to be navigated. It remains very much unclear how aggressive Anthony Albanese will be in dealing with China, or whether he might try to navigate it, the relationship, through sort of more diplomatic means.
So, Misha, finally, if you look down on these results in Australia from 35,000 feet, what would you say has actually changed?
It's Australia's first climate election in which voters have expressed a significant and strong preference for action on climate change. And in doing so, they've turfed out a conservative government that's existed for almost a decade now. So it's a really significant change in Australian politics, and I think a change that will be felt significantly over the next 5 to 10 years.
Misha Ketchel is editor of The Conversation, Australia and New Zealand. Misha, thank you very much for taking the time. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
It was a scorcher here in New England this past weekend. Temps in the high 90s had us running for the popsicles. Nothing, though, compared with India and Pakistan. The mercury there has topped out at 110 to 115 degrees Fahrenheit in recent weeks. A new report about the region's heat wave confirms a usual suspect, climate change. Joining us now is the report's lead researcher, Mariam Zakaria. She's also with the Grantham Institute at Imperial College in London. Mariam, how were you able to attribute climate change as the main cause of the recent heat wave between India and Pakistan?
When we talk about climate change, we normally see it as trends in the global mean surface temperatures. And in this case, the main trigger that led us to sort of attribute this event was because of its unseasonal occurrence. So it sort of happened earlier in this year, in March, April, when heat waves are not so common in India and in Pakistan.
You know, I always hear scientists say that we can't attribute any one weather event to climate change, but we're talking an event that happened in March and April. How were you able to determine this so quickly?
All extreme events are unique. You see, so every event will have a driving factor. When you look at an event, and we say, especially in terms of this event, as with many of the recent heat wave events, you hear that the temperatures are much higher, which is consistent with the climate change signal. Rather than the driving causes, what we are trying to do here is we are trying to see the magnitudes that we see this year, whether that was attributable to climate change or not.
So let me just push you on that a little bit. I mean, how can you say with certainty that what's happening right now is due to climate change and not just some meteorological blip?
We are not talking about the drivers here, but rather it is the temperatures, the magnitudes that we saw this year. So we have climate change that is happening, and we see that the temperatures are rising on a global level. When you look at the regional temperatures also, you will see that there's a consistent increase in the temperature magnitudes, which is consistent with the overall climate change signal. So there is no question of whether this was due to climate change, because it is clear that it is due to climate change.
Give us a snapshot then of the impact on the local population in India and Pakistan in the affected areas, like from human health to what this means for farmers.
This year, with the temperature records going off the charts, we've already heard that the wheat crop, in terms of the yields, it's been dwindling. Although we do not have an accurate figure out yet as from the government. What we know for now is that it can be anywhere from 10 to 30% reduction in the overall production over these regions.
Did people die in the March and April heat waves in Pakistan and India?
What we know is that around 90 people died in these regions due to heat stroke. But, we still have to wait a couple of months before the accurate statistics come out. It is too soon to give a proper number.
What can the governments of India and Pakistan do to combat these heat waves? I mean, how can they save people and crops before it's too late?
In terms of the health impacts, many of the cities in India have come up with these heat adaptation plans called climate action plans. So one of them being, painting the roofs white so as to reflect more sunlight so that there will be more cooling indoors. Then there would be greening. So there are many, many strategies that are in place. And with regards to the crops, some of the strategies include, looking at early cropping, early sowing so that the harvesting can be done a little before March, the dry season begins. The other strategy would be a long-term strategy where you continue the research on developing more heat-tolerant varieties that can withstand higher temperatures in terms of the major food crops in India.
Mariam Zakaria is a research associate at the Grantham Institute at Imperial College in London. Mariam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. War, famine, and disaster have now driven 100 million people from the places they live.
What we're seeing is a syndrome appearing on every continent of people being forced from their homes.
Diplomacy, legal protection, and governments are failing people across the globe. A moment for reflection and for action, coming up this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. War zones are places where new technology is often tested and unleashed. In the war in Ukraine, there's something that's taken hold within the Ukrainian army: facial recognition software. In a special report from the podcast Click Here, here's the story of a facial recognition program called Clearview AI and questions that swirl around how it's used on the battlefield. Dina Temple-Raston is the host of Click Here and has this report.
Clearview AI makes a groundbreaking facial recognition app. It allows users to take a picture of someone, upload it to its database, and match it to a publicly identified photo. In just seconds, it puts a name to a face. And now, Clearview AI is in Ukraine.
And originally, I would see photos of captured Russian soldiers. And I realized with that kind of quality of photo, our facial recognition technology could be helpful.
Juan Tontat is the founder and chief executive officer of Clearview, and he gave us a rare interview.
So I reached out to a lot of people on our advisory board to ask them and, you know, investors, whoever it was, do you know anyone in the Ukrainian government?
Turns out a member of their advisory board was leaving for Ukraine the very next day, and Tontat gave him a letter to take with him. It wasn't so much a pitch as a list of what Tontat thought Clearview AI might be able to do to help the war effort. Things like identifying suspects who were caught by surveillance cameras committing crimes or identifying spies at the border.
Didn't hear back for a while, but we kept trying every single avenue. And then we got an email in our inbox saying, with a few questions about the facial recognition technology.
A Ukrainian defense official was interested, he said. And Clearview ended up offering its subscription service to Ukrainian investigators for free. Which has been controversial because Clearview AI has been under fire for the way it built its database in the first place. It scraped some 20 billion images from social networks and other online sources from all over the world. And it did that without asking the websites or the people in the photographs for consent. That's why big tech companies like Google and Facebook have demanded Clearview cease and desist, and why individual states, even countries like Britain and Italy, have filed lawsuits to make them stop. Clearview argues the pictures are already public, so the data collection is protected by the First Amendment, which is an argument that might wash in the U.S., but doesn't account for all those photos the company has collected elsewhere. And that's just the beginning. Clearview hopes to have ingested 100 billion images within a year. So if you do the math, that's almost 13 photographs for every person on Earth. And now, six agencies and some 400 Ukrainian investigators have logins for the service.
We thought that it can be used to, you know, identify if someone is who they say they are, along with potentially reuniting families or with refugee situations.
And Ukraine has found uses for Clearview that have surprised even Tontat, like identifying bodies on the battlefield.
The deceased soldiers part, you know, we thought it was possible, but to actually see it in reality, some of the photos are very gruesome, but it is something that changes the dynamics of war.
Can you tell me, have you ever used facial recognition software before?
Yes.
And is it fast?
Yes, it's just seconds. It depends on the quality of the picture and depends on the...
Ukraine has a Department of National Police, and the head of their IT is a guy named Leonid Timchenko.
M-C-H-E-N-K-O. Timchenko.
He says Clearview AI is helping his team in lots of ways. In addition to helping them put names to Russians who might have been looting or killing civilians, he's been using it to identify the war dead, which is harder than it sounds. Well, sometimes the dead have papers or dog tags or some kind of identification. In this conflict, a lot of them do not. Their uniforms are curiously without rank or insignia or name. Timchenko says Clearview has been helping them with that since March.
We see very good results in recognizing even dead bodies, which is actually very good because, as you can imagine, speaking about dead soldiers, it's not always when they have like pretty face, let's say.
You mean that part of the face may be damaged somehow?
Yes, exactly.
In a war that has been awash in misinformation, Timchenko says Clearview is helping ground the conflict in truth, and in some cases, brutal truths. Timchenko shared his computer screen. On it was a photograph of a Russian soldier. He was dusty and twisted, wedged in a gully as if killed in the act of ducking for cover. There was no obvious identification on his uniform.
We took a photo of his face from this photo and put it to the Clearview AI tool. And there were actually no direct results, but there were 19 additional results. Maybe it's
the app surfaced photographs it thought could be a match. Think of it as the AI saying, here are some options the algorithm isn't sure about. I need a human to take a look, a human like Timchenko.
So searching another 19 results, I was managed to identify the person with the social network Odnoklassniki. It's like classmates translated into English. Searching his photos, I managed to get information that he is a military person. He is a soldier of Russian army, and his name is Nikolai Kirkin.
He looks very different in the picture because he doesn't have a mustache and things like that.
Yes, there is no mustache, and maybe these pictures, they are from, let's say, 2, 3, maybe even more years. So this is this person. And you can compare if you will take two pictures together.
Timchenko showed me the pictures side by side.
So you will see that actually it's the same person.
They did look like the same person. A fresh, cleanly shaven young man in one picture, the twisted figure in the other. Having an accounting of these people is important for all kinds of reasons, from getting accurate casualty figures to gathering evidence of war crimes. Timchenko says his unit has identified about 5,000 people since March, people like Russian soldiers who appear to have looted Ukrainian homes. A surveillance camera at a local post office caught them shipping washing machines and other big-ticket items back to Russia. Now other branches of Ukrainian law enforcement are clamoring for their own accounts.
It's also cyber police. It's also Department of Criminal Analysis. Our investigators, they also use this technology. They have accounts from Clearview. And we hope we will able to provide free accounts to our patrol police.
And then there's this thing I hadn't thought about until he mentioned it. While most facial recognition systems rely on recognizing people with their eyes open, Clearview can identify people even if their eyes are closed.
For example, it's impossible to unblock a cell phone if your eyes are closed. So Clearview is able to identify people with a damaged face, people who have their eyes closed.
Which just gives you an idea of how far facial recognition technology has come.
That's Dina Temple-Raston, host of the cyber and intelligence podcast, Click Here. The advent of facial recognition poses ethical questions about how the technology is used and whether its uses are constrained. That's where Dina Temple-Raston picks up the story.
So let's start with an easy one. Could you introduce yourself to us, please?
Oh, wow. Okay.
Okay, that was supposed to be an easy one.
Let me start over. And so what I did over here is I have
Jackie Singh is a former Iraq veteran who joined the military when she was just 17.
So I signed my name on the dotted line, and because I was 17, my mom had to sign for me as well.
She was part of the early 2000s underground hacking scene. Then, when she was in Iraq, first as a member of the military and then later as a military contractor, she saw military surveillance firsthand.
Surveillance operations in a war zone are ubiquitous. We're talking about drones. We're talking about aerostat blimps, which were these very large suspended blimps up in the air that were tethered to the ground.
So when you were in Iraq, did you feel like this technology was being used in the right way?
I never had any reservations.
These days, Jackie Singh has come full circle. Now she works for a nonprofit advocating against facial recognition and mass surveillance. And she says data collection has just gone too far.
I have never been involved in a data collection effort where the conversation was anything other than how do we get more data? It's never about the ethics of it. It's never about should we? We can do these things, but should we? And the answer is absolutely always yes.
And even if the people collecting all this data are doing all this for the right reasons, sooner or later, the information falls into the hands of someone who uses it in a way that wasn't intended. And this isn't just hypothetical. It's already happened in Ukraine.
На связи IT Army. В Украине идет масштабная и кровопролитная война.
So that's a crazy video from the Ukrainian IT Army, a kind of quasi-government-backed group of international hackers. The video feels like something straight out of Mr. Robot, only Ukrainian. They've leaked Russian documents or cracked into Russian television. all in a bid to try to reach the Russian public and tell them the truth about the war. And that video? It looks like Clearview AI is in it. It shows a computer screen loading up a photo of a dead Russian soldier into what looks like the Clearview program. And then, very quickly, it identifies him. The voice in the video is unveiling a new IT Army initiative. They decided to call Russian families directly to tell them their kids had died in the war, and then they'd send them photographic proof. Not in a nice way, but in a demoralizing way. Timchenko said it wasn't his guys, and doesn't have an explanation for how this could have happened.
Such volunteers, what they are doing, they are somehow they manage to identify cell phones and personal numbers, phone numbers of their relatives, and they call in them.
They send pictures of the dead to family or post it on Telegram.
And they, like, admitted they are trying to pretend that they are Russian officers, and they provide an information that, you know, your son was dead. I don't know if it's really correct. It's not my part of job, and it's not something which I would like to do, but maybe it's another possibility to provide a real picture of what is going on here in Ukraine. But we don't use Clearview AI to make such things.
We've reached out numerous times to the IT Army, asking them to explain how they got their hands on what looks like a Clearview search. We didn't get a response.
Look, if I thought it would be used in a really bad way, then I don't think that, you know, give access to them.
When we asked Ton Tat, he said that, quote, the speculation that the IT Army is running a Clearview AI search does not match any information we have. We asked him later if he thought it might be a spoof search, and he didn't respond. Whatever happened, whether Clearview or someone else explicitly gave access to the IT Army, is a little beside the point. An unauthorized person appears to be using the database for an unintended purpose. Ton Tat said a lot of this was beyond his control.
What we can control as Clearview is, you know, giving access to the right people. A lot of these agencies and investigators have their own, you know, procedures. And so I can't speak to exactly how they, you know, deploy everything and all that stuff. But they have assured me that they want to make sure that's done in the right and humane way.
The problem is that assurances really don't amount to much. Procedures don't either. Critics say facial recognition is an unregulated space. And if you put something like that in a war zone, bad things are bound to happen. After all, it's war.
It must be tremendously hard to think about every way someone could use something that you meant for good, could turn it on its head for bad.
Yeah, something we think about all the time, right? But when we started Clearview, we were really thinking of the use cases first. And I think that's our philosophy, is you can always make technology, but let's focus on the best use case and the highest purpose of something.
Which may be a little naive, because it isn't just the all-volunteer IT Army that's reaching out to Russian families. Last week, the head of Ukraine's Ministry of Digital Transformation said that his team was sending photos to families too, partly to tell them the truth about the war, and partly to tell them if they wanted to pick up the bodies, they could come to Ukraine. Timchenko says he doesn't know of any police investigators abusing their Clearview access, but he said he wasn't really looking for it either.
To tell the truth, I didn't have such kind of goal, maybe, to check as an administrator. I don't know. I think maybe there is a possibility to use it in some kind of incorrect way, but so far we are focusing only on war crimes. And we didn't spend much time checking what our guys are doing.
Timchenko is focused on his job, and it's hard to blame him. More than 11,000 war crimes have been registered with the Office of Ukraine's Prosecutor General since the war began. Ukraine marks the first major conflict in which we've seen facial recognition technology deployed on such a grand scale. And it arrived without a procurement process or any real oversight. Jackie Singh says the fact that Clearview has provided all this for free masks what the company has to gain. This could further normalize facial recognition because they're making it ubiquitous.
And we just crossed the 20,000 search mark. So they're actively using it. It's about 2 months now.
Singh, for her part, worries about the things we haven't had the space to imagine yet.
So when you're
providing a technology to a battlefield in the middle of a war zone, you're introducing additional instability and insecurity to a country that hasn't had this technology, that doesn't have a real process or procedure for using it.
She says we should see Clearview in Ukraine for what it is.
We're looking at a defense contractor that is essentially widening its sphere of influence. That's all they're really doing.
This month, Clearview AI agreed to permanently stop selling access to its database to private businesses or individuals around the U.S. It was part of a settlement agreement with the ACLU in the state of Illinois. Ton Tott told us it could be a template for other state suits the company is facing. And he seems sanguine about it all. He says this is how technologies mature.
So like any new technology, I say like the automobile, for example, when they invented the car, there were no lanes, there were no, you know, traffic lights and no seatbelts. And those things all came over time. And that's the life cycle of technology. Something's invented, people have to figure out what it's good for, what it's bad for. And then a period of adoption where people start using it, and then a period of regulation.
But unlike, say, a car, in this case, the technology sweeps up intimate details from all of us without our knowing. It could be my iris scans from when I reported in Iraq, your wedding pictures in Paris, or the snapshots from the company picnic posted on Facebook. Leonid Timchenko says a lot of his officers want their own Clearview logins.
And we have so many requests for these.
And he's already asked for more. For The World, I'm Dina Temple-Raston.
Dina Temple-Raston is the host of the podcast Click Here, covering the world of cyber and intelligence. This story was produced by Will Jarvis and Sean Powers. Today, a UK regulator took action against Clearview AI. The Information Commissioner's Office fined the company nearly $9.5 million and ordered it to delete the data of UK residents from its systems. Home. No matter where on earth you live, home is a place many of us count on and treasure. But for 100 million people across the globe, home is a thing they've left behind. And that number, 100 million, today the UN's High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, reported that's how many people were forcibly displaced from their homes around the world. A sad new record. Here to help us put that staggering figure into context is David Miliband. He heads the International Rescue Committee. He's also former Foreign Secretary for the UK. We are living in a time of multiple crises. So what is your reaction to this figure, 100 million displaced people?
Well, the figure is obviously shocking, but so is the rise that it represents, because essentially the number of people displaced by conflict and persecution and disaster in the last decade has more than doubled. That's internally displaced, the people who are homeless within their own country, now about 60 million, and then the people who are homeless and have been forced across a border into a neighboring country, that's 40 million. And so I think we've got to understand that this is both a shocking snapshot, but there's also a trend here. And the trend is of what I call system failure. Diplomacy is failing, which is why wars are burning for longer. The legal regime that protects civilians from violence is failing, so more people flee. And states are failing in their own responsibility to their own citizens, not just that they're too poor to support them, because this isn't an economic question. This is a violence and political persecution question. They're actually committing acts against their own citizens that are driving their own citizens out of their own country. And so I think it is beyond a wake-up call. It's a moment for more than reflection. It's a moment for action.
Well, we'll talk about action in a moment. I'm just wondering, David Miliband, how long have you been watching this number grow of both refugees and internally displaced people? And what does the mark of 100 million mean to you personally?
Well, my parents were refugees, so I have some sense of connection to the trauma. I think that what we're seeing is a syndrome appearing on every continent now of people being forced from their homes. And we're seeing a trend where wars within states are out of control, 55 civil conflicts within states. But now with the Ukraine crisis, what we're seeing is a global awakening, which at least holds the prospect that something might come out of it. Now, at the moment, the trends are all in the wrong direction, but maybe out of the Ukraine crisis, which has prompted this extraordinary outpouring of governmental and public attention, there's a chance of turning things around.
I'm speaking with David Miliband, the head of the IRC, the International Rescue Committee. So let's look at the numbers here. I mean, 1% of the world's population has been forced to leave home. If that was a country, the displaced would be the 14th most populous nation in the world. Who are these displaced people? Like, where are they from?
1, Ukraine. 2, Afghanistan. 3, South Sudan. 4, Myanmar. 5, Venezuela. 6, the Central Triangle in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras. 7, Ethiopia. So the top 10 is spread around the world. And I don't want to forget in the top 10, Syria, because it's now 11 years into the Syria conflict. There remain 8 million internally displaced, 6 million refugees from Syria, and there's no prospect of them going back. So that's where they're from. Here's the other side of the equation. Where are they going? 85% of the world's refugees are in poor or lower middle income countries, not in rich countries, probably 80% now if you include the Ukraine crisis. Mm. Another important myth that needs to be dispelled, people think refugees are in camps because refugee camps, because that's the image from the Second World War. About 70% of refugees are now in urban areas, not in camps. So it's an urban experience. And then one final statistic, half of the world's refugees are under the age of 18. They're children.
Right. And as you pointed out earlier, the most recent conflict having a huge impact is the one in Ukraine, Russia's war there. You recently witnessed, David Miliband, firsthand what was happening there. What did you see in Ukraine that took you by surprise?
The most striking thing is that every conversation has fear an inch below the surface. Everyone has a mobile phone in Ukraine, and every family has a father, a brother, a husband who's in the armed forces. And so every conversation with a woman or a child is permeated by a sense that terrible news is around the corner. Never mind the trauma of having left everything physical behind. They've left their own menfolk behind. And I met Ukrainians inside Ukraine as well as in Moldova, the neighboring state that's housing about 100,000 refugees. And it's the fear that's there. Of course, there's a hope to go home, but there's no immediate expectation of that being possible. One thing that makes the Ukraine crisis different, however, is that refugees from Ukraine are able to flee to Europe. And I met Ukrainians in Berlin, in Germany, and I talked to policymakers in Brussels. And the fact that the European Union has promised 3 years safe harbor, 3 years residency, 3 years work permits, 3 years education and other social services at least provides a modicum of mitigation of the circumstance of the refugees, and I think sets a standard for what needs to happen to refugees elsewhere.
Many Western nations are rallying to support Ukrainians who are displaced. At the same time, asylum seekers along the U.S. and borders of the EU have little hope of entry. What do you make of that double standard?
We deplore any double standard. I did actually meet the European Commissioner for Home Affairs last week, and it's important to say that there were some very, very indefensible practices on the Ukraine side of the border in early March when Africans and Indians were not given proper treatment. But now in Europe, if you were a Afghan refugee in Ukraine, you have been given 3 years residence just as Ukrainian refugees into Europe have been given that as well. And the standard that we hold governments to is a standard of equal treatment.
So Ukrainian refugees are permitted 3 years of work and residency in Europe. To state the obvious, they're white, they're European, so they're treated differently. How does that different treatment reverberate globally?
The important lesson that we've drawn from the early stages of the Ukraine crisis, which you're rightly drawing attention to, is that the differential treatment that was allowed in the first 5 to 7 days sent a terrible message around the world, and one that is very, very important to correct through actions, not just through propaganda. And from our point of view as an international humanitarian agency, it's vital to uphold the principle that a refugee deserves rights on the basis of their status, not the basis of their nationality. And anyone who is in fear of their life, anyone for whom it's not safe to return home, should be given the support, not just the promise that they won't be returned home, but be given proper support that the leading nations are able to do. And when I talk of leading nations, I don't only think of Western nations. To give you the example of Uganda, which has welcomed up 1.5 million South Sudanese, they're given land, they're given rights to work, they're given education for their kids. That's the kind of standard that we need to see much more widely.
David Miliband is the head of the International Rescue Committee. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for your time.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.